Hey, this is John Lee Dumas from EO Fire, and you're listening to Elective Rotation with Pharmacy Joe. You must be prepared to ignite.
What's up, Pharmacy Nation? I'm Pharmacy Joe. Thank you for listening to the Elective Rotation, a critical care pharmacy podcast. This is episode 34, Severe Hyperkalemia Treatment. I have all the evidence supporting today's show linked up in the show notes at pharmacyjoe.com/episode34. If you know someone who would find this podcast helpful, please share the show notes with them. Before we get to the topic for today's show, I want to let you know about the Pharmacy Nation Slack group. This is a free group with other pharmacists from around the world collaborating with each other using real-time messaging to help better care for patients. I hope you join me and the over 90 other Pharmacy Nation members there. You can sign up at pharmacynation.org. In this episode, I'll review how to recognize severe hyperkalemia, review the three categories of hyperkalemia treatments and the order in which they should be used, and discuss the nuances of each of these treatments. Severe hyperkalemia can be recognized by cardiac conduction abnormalities on the ECG, muscle weakness, paralysis, or a serum potassium value greater than 7. In a patient without chronically high potassium, a value lower than 7 may still have severe consequences. While a patient with severe hyperkalemia can progress from any level of ECG change to ventricular tachycardia, V-fib, or asystole, in general, a peak T wave with a shortened QT interval is the earliest changed, followed by progressive lengthening of the PR interval and QRS duration. The P wave may disappear, and ultimately the QRS widens further to a sine wave until asystole occurs. Don't bother trying to learn at which level of potassium the ECG changes occur. The changes do not correlate well with the serum potassium concentration. In the show notes, I have two ECG tracings from a patient, first when they have a potassium of 7.5, and if you go there, pharmacyjoe.com/episode34, you'll be able to see flattened P waves, the wide QRS interval, and peak T waves. And then you'll see a second tracing of the same patient after correction of their serum potassium has begun. And you'll see the T waves still peaked, but the P waves and QRS waves back to normal. So I invite you to check that out in the show notes. If hyperkalemia is suspected, and you don't have point-of-care testing like at my hospital, the fastest way to get the serum potassium is to send a venous blood gas sample to the lab for analysis. Now, sending a VBG is the fastest way to get sodium, potassium, glucose, and free calcium levels at my hospital with a turnaround time of 15 minutes or less. Treatment of hyperkalemia should follow a three-step process. In my experience, a pharmacist at the bedside can play a significant role in ensuring the steps are followed in the proper order. And the steps are, number one, protect the cardiac membrane with IV calcium. Number two, hide the potassium from the heart. Number three, remove the excess potassium from the patient. Now, first let's talk about protecting the cardiac membrane with IV calcium. IV calcium works within minutes to protect cardiac membranes from the deleterious effects of hyperkalemia. Two forms of calcium are available to be given IV, and they have a few important differences. The two forms are calcium gluconate and calcium chloride. Calcium chloride can be given IV push, but causes a significant amount of phlebitis and tissue injury in extravasation, so it is best used if there is a life-threatening arrhythmia present or a central line is in place. The dose for severe hyperkalemia is 1 gram IV push over 1 minute. Calcium gluconate is less potent and causes less venous irritation. It must be given at a slower rate of about 150 milligrams per minute to avoid hypotension. Calcium gluconate is best used if the patient has a small peripheral IV line and can safely tolerate waiting about 15 minutes for the dose to infuse. The dose for severe hyperkalemia is 2 to 3 grams by IV infusion over 15 to 20 minutes. Now, whether calcium gluconate or calcium chloride is used, the dose should be repeated if the ECG change has not normalized within 5 minutes of administration of calcium. The cardiac membrane stabilization effects of calcium last 30 to 60 minutes. So immediately following calcium administration, it's time to work on moving the excess potassium into the intracellular space where it won't harm the cardiac membrane. I call this hiding the potassium from the heart. The intracellular concentrations of sodium and potassium are essentially the reverse of the plasma concentrations. This is why a couple extra MEQs of potassium doesn't do any harm inside cells, but has a tremendous impact on the outside of cells. While there are three strategies for moving potassium inside of cells, only one of them is worth considering routinely in patients with hyperkalemia. The three strategies are number one, IV insulin, number two, high-dose nebulized albuterol, number three, IV sodium bicarbonate. I think of insulin like a key that unlocks a door in cell membranes to allow glucose, potassium, and water to walk through. Giving 10 units of regular insulin IV should be enough to lower a patient's potassium to a safe level. This should be followed with 25 to 50 grams of IV dextrose to prevent hypoglycemia. Even if the patient is already hyperglycemic, some IV dextrose should be given to ensure hypoglycemia does not develop. Either way, it's prudent to check a finger stick 1 hour after giving the IV insulin plus dextrose combination to treat hyperkalemia. Nebulized albuterol is effective at moving potassium inside cells, but the necessary dose of 20 milligrams is not practical to give. 20 milligrams is 4 to 8 times the usual dose for asthma. You'll need undiluted albuterol for nebulization to give 20 milligrams. And I can't imagine how bad the side effects of tachycardia and tremor would be. I've never encountered a clinical scenario where I thought this was the thing to do, and I can't think of a scenario that I'd use this treatment strategy in. Now, the third option, IV sodium bicarbonate. Sodium bicarb administration will not have effect on potassium levels until several hours of a bicarb infusion have elapsed. After 4 to 6 hours, if the patient with hyperkalemia also had metabolic acidosis, the serum potassium will decrease by just over half an MEQ per liter. That's not enough to make a difference for a patient with severe hyperkalemia. I think sodium bicarbonate's only role would be as an adjunct to insulin and dextrose in a patient with concomitant metabolic acidosis. And now it's time to move to the third step in the treatment of severe hyperkalemia, and that is removing excess potassium from the patient. You've protected the patient's heart from potassium. You've moved the extra potassium inside of cells. Get that extra potassium out of the patient. Now, the treatment that immediately comes to mind, sodium polystyrene sulfate, may not be effective at all for the treatment of acute severe hyperkalemia. And I've linked up a couple resources in the show notes, one article and also a podcast episode from mcrit.org where a guest was on discussing how sodium polystyrene sulfate is really not something that you want to be using in patients. So sodium polystyrene sulfate, or SPS, is a cation exchange resin, and it trades a harmless sodium ion for a potassium ion in the lumen of the GI tract. The best evidence available suggests that this medication is no more effective than laxative use for lowering serum potassium levels. And I was really surprised when I read that. While not common, SPS can cause intestinal necrosis, a potentially fatal complication. Now, certain conditions lead to a higher incidence of intestinal necrosis from SPS and should be considered absolute contraindications to use. And those are use in postoperative patients, patients with an ileus or who are receiving opioids, and patients with a bowel obstruction. For severe hyperkalemia, the treatment of choice to remove excess potassium is hemodialysis. After hemodialysis, expect the potassium concentration to rebound. For this reason, you should wait a little bit after hemodialysis completes to remeasure the serum potassium to make sure you're getting a true reading. If hemodialysis is not readily available, and the patient has one of the contraindications that I listed previously to SPS, the patient should be managed with bolus or continuous infusions of insulin and dextrose until arrangements for dialysis can be made. I should note that a new potassium exchange resin, Patiromer, has been approved in the U.S. However, this resin has not been studied in the treatment of acute hyperkalemia, and there are no trials registered on clinicaltrials.gov examining Patiromer for this indication. I'm putting together a course on how to start a medical podcast so that other medical professionals can bring their knowledge, expertise, and voice to the world of podcasting. To learn more about the course and to sign up to be notified when it's available, head over to howtostartamedicalpodcast.com. Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you in the next episode of the Elective Rotation.